Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to The Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet. Bringing the world's top experts right to you. Introducing your hosts, Matt Bodner and Austin Fable.
Welcome to The Science of Success, the number one evidence-based growth podcast on the internet, with more than 5 million downloads and listeners in over 100 countries. In this episode, we discuss conscious capitalism, transformational leadership lessons, and how to use win-win thinking to create breakthroughs in your business with Whole Foods co-founder and CEO, John Mackey. Are you a fan of the show and have you been enjoying the content that we put together for you? If you have, I would love it if you signed up for our email list. We have some amazing content on there along with a really great free course that we put a ton of time into called How to Create Time for What Matters Most in Your Life. If that sounds exciting and interesting, and you want a bunch of other free goodies and giveaways along with that, just go to successpodcast.com. You can sign up right on the homepage. That's successpodcast.com. Or if you're on your phone right now, all you have to do is text the word SMARTER, that's SMARTER, to the number 44222. In our previous episode, we shared powerful strategies for dealing with uncertainty, some of the most important tools for making better decisions, and how to get more flexibility in your life with returning guest Josh Kaufman. Now, for our interview with John. John Mackey is the CEO and co-founder of Whole Foods Market, co-founder of the nonprofit Conscious Capitalism, Inc., and co-author of the best-selling book, Conscious Capitalism. Under his leadership, Whole Foods has grown to be a $13 billion Fortune 500 company. John's skills as CEO have been recognized by Ernst & Young, Barron, Fortune, and many more outlets. He's recently co-authored another conscious business book, Conscious Leadership, Elevating Humanity Through Business. John, welcome to The Science of Success.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here talking with you.
Well, we are super excited to have you on the show today. Conscious Capitalism has been on my bookshelf for a long time, and it's a book that's really shaped a lot of my thinking about the world and the thinking of many of my close business associates as well. One of the themes from Conscious Capitalism that really, to me, is a transformative idea that I think is really misunderstood in many ways in today's world is this notion that business in and of itself is a social good. It's something that's inherently good. It's something that creates value, that does good in the world. I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Well, I have a very strong perspective on it. I think business is the greatest creator of value in the world. It is business and capitalism that has literally, in the last 250 years, lifted humanity out of the dirt. If you go back 250 years ago, 85% of everyone alive on the planet Earth lived on less than $1 a day. Think about that. 94% lived on less than $2 a day, and that's for in today's dollars. The average lifespan was 30. Illiteracy rates were over 90%. Capitalism's completely changed that, and it's been business, of course, is what it's business freely creating, innovating, and trading with each other that has allowed humanity to make such tremendous progress. So business is inherently good because it's based on voluntary exchange. No one has to trade with anybody else. If you don't like the terms of the deal, don't make the deal. Don't make the trade. And competition breaks up monopolies, and innovation breaks up monopolies over time. And the result is a continuous improvement in society. So business hasn't done it by itself, obviously. Science, good government, there's a lot of factors that have led to human progress. But business is inherently good, and it's been the major driver of it.
And you, with everything that you've done and all that you've built, and even in conscious capitalism, you really take the core framework of capitalism and even expand it beyond what its traditional kind of roots and structure look like. But even at its core, if you're not necessarily in a business that is as pro-social as something like, let's say, a Whole Foods, even just the act of creating jobs and investing in the economy and making capital improvements, all of those things are hugely beneficial for everyone, raising the standard of living in a massive way, as you said. I mean, those are tremendously valuable to our entire society.
They are. Intellectuals have never liked merchants. So this is not new news here. The intellectual class has always looked down on commerce as sort of, you know, dirty tradesman type of work. Noble people would never engage in trade. It's always been sort of something that's been looked down upon. And yet business is fundamentally good because it creates value for other people. I mean, that's what it does. It comes up with unique ways to give people what they want. And I want to put it underscore what they want as opposed to what they need, because the assumption of business is people are the best judges for what they need and what they want. And business provides that. So they can provide things that maybe aren't good for people, but that's what people want. So it sets up a paradox there a little bit. But it creates value for people. It creates value for customers. And that's how business succeeds. If it doesn't create value for people, then people don't vote for it with their pocketbooks. If people don't like Whole Foods Market, if they think it's too expensive or our quality's not good enough, then they shop at our competitors. And in fact, most people don't like Whole Foods. The reality is, we have about a 3% market share. So most people don't shop at Whole Foods or shop there only occasionally. And yet we've got about a $20 billion business now because enough people shop in our small little niche to let us be successful on a large scale. But business doesn't just create value for customers. It creates value for all the employees. Again, no one's forced to work for any particular company. They do so because it's the best job they can find at that particular time that meets their desire for employment, their skill set, with a pay that they may not be completely happy with, but the best pay they can find in the competitive marketplace, or they go find another job. So business does create jobs. I mean, Whole Foods is, we've created 100,000 jobs from zero in the last 40 years. We have 100,000 people working for the company now. It creates value for suppliers, right? Because Whole Foods has about 10,000 suppliers that we do business with, all these local producers all over the country, all over the world, really. And they're not forced to trade with us. They trade with us because we're creating value for them and they're creating value for us. It's a win-win. It creates value for investors. Business people invest in a company like Whole Foods. And if the company prospers and succeeds and they get a return on that capital, they get a return on their investment. But also businesses create value for the communities they're in, not only because they create value for customers and employees through jobs and suppliers through trading with them, but they create value because they are oftentimes paying a lot of taxes to the cities and communities and states, as well as the country that they're part of. They also tend to be philanthropic. They give a percentage or a certain amount of their money to local communities or larger communities that they're part of. So business is this great value creator. In fact, I would argue business creates far more value than all the governments and all the nonprofits combined. Not to say that governments and nonprofits don't create value too. It's just that they're ultimately dependent upon business because the tax money ultimately comes from business. And nonprofit donations ultimately come from business as well, either business or the people the business employs. So I do think business is obviously not perfect. I wouldn't have written a book called Conscious Capitalism. I say business is good, and we can make it more conscious and we can make it better. And so that book is dedicated to that proposition.
And I couldn't agree more with that perspective and the idea that both of those pieces of that statement are critical. Business is good, and it can always be improved. It can always be made better. And in many ways, you championing this idea of stakeholder theory, this notion that businesses can and should create value, not just for their investors and their shareholders, but for everyone that's a stakeholder, the community, the employees, et cetera, that's such a critical concept. And yet many people misunderstand some of the fundamental underpinnings of that. What do people get wrong when they think about stakeholder theory?
That's such a good question. The main problem people have is from very early age, we take on a win-lose framework of the world, that sports are that way, games are that way. We're always in competition, whether in school, academia, and this idea that if you're winning, somebody else is losing. And that's, of course, one of the big criticisms about business, that it's sort of a winner-take-all, win-lose. Somebody's getting rich, so somebody else is getting poor. That's very powerfully set in most people's consciousness, this idea of somebody's winning and somebody else is losing. They're going to be one champion in sports, so then everybody else is a loser. But business isn't that way. In business, because it's based on voluntary exchange and it's creating value voluntarily for customers, employees, suppliers, investors, and communities that they're part of, business is inherently a win-win-win game. It's about creating value for all of these. And I suppose in stakeholder theory, and I really got this many, many years ago, early on, I'm very fortunate that I learned this lesson, but I learned it deeper as time went by, that basically all the major stakeholders are interdependent on one another. And what I began to realize is that you don't manage the business in terms of trade-offs. So, okay, if I'm going to pay more, then that means there's going to be less profits made, or we're going to have to raise prices for customers. It's not that there's not these connections between those. It's just that you begin to strategize and think about the business differently. How do we simultaneously create value for all of them? How do we optimize the larger system that all these stakeholders are part of? So stakeholder management, in a way, is seeing that they're connected together. And then you begin to come up with strategies where they all can simultaneously win. So I always say that if you come up with strategies where one of the stakeholders is losing, it's a bad strategy. You should throw it out and go back to the drawing board. You haven't been imaginative enough. You haven't been creative enough. There actually is a win-win-win that you have to figure out so that all the stakeholders are winning. And this is particularly relevant. I don't want to get into politics in this incredibly polarized time that we're living in. I will say, though, that once you adopt a win-win-win framework, it can become a complete ethical system. You can think about every interaction you have with everyone. You ask, how do I make sure Matt is winning here? And how do I make sure that I'm also winning? How do we both win? So I'm not looking in my interactions with people for somebody else to be put down, for somebody else to be lessened, for somebody else to lose. I'm trying to figure out how to serve them so they win. And as they win, I also win, that we're winning together. And that is really what, once you have this framework, you'd see that what America needs right now is to adopt a win-win-win philosophy. We have all of this win-lose struggle going on, where one set of values is trying to win at the expense of the other values. And this tension exists all through the society right now. So you particularly see it in politics. You have these two parties that hate each other and want the other one to lose. And there's no compromise. There's no working together. And it's just trying to vanquish the other side. And so in the book, we have a chapter called Find Win-Win-Win Solutions. How do we begin to think differently so that we create solutions where everybody's winning? How do we create a win-win-win society? I know you can create win-win-win businesses because I've done it, but can you create win-win-win societies? Absolutely believe you can. Hence, one of the reasons we wrote Conscious Leadership. We need conscious leaders everywhere. We need them in business. We need them in education. We need them in politics. We need them in the nonprofit sector. We need them in government. We need them everywhere.
So well said. And I couldn't agree with you more. Even the example you gave a moment ago about how the standard of living has increased exponentially in the last 250 years is a perfect illustration of the idea that the pie, especially economic, but really more broadly than that, the pie is not a finite amount of resources that are being distributed to winners and losers. If you grow the whole pie, the entire society benefits. And that's something that isn't intuitive and isn't easy to understand. And really, especially in today's culture, today's world where it's so polarized, it almost goes against our innate gut feeling, but it's really fundamental to understanding not only the power of capitalism and conscious capitalism, but the power of, as you said, conscious leadership across a huge array of social issues and challenges.
It's really, really true, Matt. I mean, great example of that is the polarization many people feel towards wealthy people. So, and that comes from this idea that there's this fixed pie. So if Jeff Bezos is a very wealthy man, richest man in the world, then he's got a bigger piece of the pie than he deserves. Or Bill Gates has that, or Warren Buffett has that, or Elon Musk has that. These entrepreneurs that have created tremendous value in the world. I mean, think how much better our lives are today because of these entrepreneurs and what they've created. And they've created their wealth. They didn't steal it. They created their wealth by creating value for other people who voluntarily exchanged with them. And of course, they're the success stories. Not every business succeeds. Not everyone becomes wealthy. Not every entrepreneur becomes wealthy. But the wealthiest entrepreneurs are actually the ones that have created the most value. They didn't steal it. And I think that's one of the myths that's out there, that somehow or another they got wealthy because they exploited the workers, or they ripped off the consumers, or they cheated their suppliers, or they've wrecked the environment. This whole idea that success comes at somebody else's expense is very deep in that win-lose framework that people are very reluctant to let go of. And yet, the pie is growing. It's grown tremendously. The average GDP per capita in the last 250 years has grown about 50x. And then not just a few people. I mean, when I said that 200 years ago, 85% of everyone alive lived on less than a dollar a day, today that's under 10%. It's about 8%. It's 8% too high. That's a lot better than 85%. And we will probably wipe out poverty on this planet before the 21st century is over. I mean, I really do believe that's almost a certainty, provided we maintain peace and maintain reasonably free enterprise and innovation. We will innovate and create more and more prosperity and lift the remaining people out of poverty.
A great perspective. And I think we're very aligned about this notion that capitalism has room for improvement, but is tremendously the most historically validated and valuable system for banishing poverty from planet Earth, basically, if you really look at the historical record.
But it's not perfect, and that's what upsets people.
That's right.
It's not perfect, because human beings aren't perfect. There are greedy people, and there are selfish people, but they're not just in business. They're in every walk of life, right? Greed is not just in business.
That's right.
You can find that in pretty much every arena of life. So capitalism will never be perfect because people are never going to be perfect. And we need limited regulations to ensure safety and ensure that people who lie, cheat, and steal are basically caught and put in jail. So capitalism is good, and we can make it better, and we can make it more conscious, and we can make our leaders more conscious. Hence why we wrote the two books.
And so let's dig into this leadership piece a little bit more, even explaining the idea of win-win-win solutions. I'd love to hear a story or an example. I'm sure you have a myriad of these from your background of how to change your perspective in a way where you can suddenly realize these win-win-win outcomes.
So whenever you're faced with a business dilemma, let's take a Whole Foods example, since obviously I know those the best. In the book, I tell the story of the merger with Amazon, and Whole Foods had shareholder activists that were trying to take over our company. They were trying to take over the board and force a sell to the highest bidder. And we didn't think that was in the best interest of all of our stakeholders. So we began to look around for what would be a win-win-win solution here. What would be something that would create value for all of our stakeholders? And frankly, we couldn't come up with a good solution for a long time. And I don't know if you ever experienced this, but sometimes my best ideas that I ever get in my life are pretty soon, right after I wake up, I've been dreaming and it's fresh in the morning. And I'm one of those guys that wakes up pretty fast. And I woke up one morning and it was the win-win-win solution for Whole Foods' shareholder activist problem just popped in my brain. And it was in the form of a question. What about Amazon? What about Amazon? Would they be interested in maybe partnering with Whole Foods, acquiring Whole Foods? Because it's like, they're not in the food business. I've heard rumors they might want to get in the food business. I'd met Jeff Bezos about a year before and hit it off with him. I really liked him. I've always admired him. He's a very brilliant guy. He's an entrepreneur in his bones, and he thinks very, very creatively. And so the more I thought about that idea, the more I began to like the idea. And I started thinking about it through a stakeholder lens. It was like, well, would this be a win for our customers? And 3 years now into the merger, I can tell you it's absolutely been a win for our customers. We've dropped our prices 3 times already. We're going to continue to drop them. We've got, with Amazon's technology, home delivery and pickup in our stores that I can tell you has gone up over 300% in the last year. I mean, obviously, COVID is an accelerant for online growth, but would Whole Foods have been able to do that without Amazon? Doubtful. And they've been able to let us think long term, because dropping your price is not that easy to do. In the short run, you're going to pay a price for it. Your same store sales will drop and your profits will drop. But Amazon's enabled us to think long term again. Was it good for our team members? Absolutely. Within just a few months of the merger, Amazon raised the starting minimum pay throughout the whole company to $15 an hour. At that time, we had about maybe 90,000 people working for the company. And 85,000 of them got a raise, not because they were below $15 an hour, but because only a few were below $15 an hour. But when you raise somebody that's at your lowest level up, you've got to raise everybody that's above them up too. So it has this ratchet effect all the way up the thing. So everybody got pay increases. We didn't lay people off. We've been able to protect jobs. As a result of the merger, we didn't have to close stores down. So it's been a win for our team members. It's been a win for our suppliers. People were worried that we were going to stop trading with local. In fact, just the opposite. We've increased our business because we've been able to grow, as well as introduce our supply chain to Amazon Fresh, to Amazon Online. And now Amazon's coming out with a new format of retail stores that are going to be branded Amazon. That's not exactly their name, but I'm not going to leak that here. And so those suppliers now have far greater outlets through this merger. Good for our investors. I mean, our company investors got about a 30% premium over what the price would have been prior to the shareholder activist coming in and getting us to do that. Good for our communities. Good for the environment. Amazon's got a huge climate change initiative and attempt to be more ethically responsible towards the environment. So every one of our stakeholders won. And thinking through the merger, every other alternative I looked at, I saw some stakeholder group losing. When I looked at Amazon, all I could see were green lights. Win, 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 win. Everybody wins. So that's using that win-win-win framework to make it the most important decision we've ever made in the history of our company, was to sell the business to Amazon. And then we did it within the stakeholder framework, and it's been tremendously successful.
Such a fascinating example. And to get a little bit of the inside baseball on your thought process around such a monumental transaction is fascinating. You touched on two things that I think are really relevant. I wanted to get into one, just more of an aside than anything, but there's actually a ton of neuroscience around that idea that some of your best ideas come after a period of what they call creative incubation, where you sleep or you do something totally different, and then you come back to the problem. It gives your subconscious the ability to process that information. But you touched briefly on something that you extrapolate more on in the book, and I think it's such a great topic that is so undervalued and underappreciated in today's broader marketplace, and that's the power and the importance of long-term thinking. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Think long-term is one of the 9 chapters in the book, and it's a very important one. It's particularly important in business, and particularly in the public marketplaces. There's so much pressure for short-term earnings that if you're a public company, it wears you down over time, because if you miss an earnings for a quarter, your stock can get absolutely obliterated. It could drop 50%. I mean, it could just blow up in one day, and the CEO and their management team are at risk of losing their jobs. That forces them to think, how do I make the next quarter? And they begin to narrow their thinking away from the long term into short term activities. Again, one of the big wins for us in merging with Amazon is And Jeff Bezos in particular really thinks long term. And I've seen that over and over again since the merger. They're enabling Whole Foods to think long term as well. So long term is very important because you have to make decisions that hopefully will not cost you too much in the short run, but which are going to pay off for you in the long term. I'll give you an example. Whole Foods, we've got about 515 stores. And a typical store, when we sign a new lease, we're signing a lease for 20 years, usually with some options that go on after that. So we're locked in to pay rent for at least a minimum of 20 years. And that means we better get a location that's going to flourish over the long term. We don't think about, is it going to be successful the first year? Is it going to be successful in year three, year four, year five, year 10? And that's the question we're always asking as we go through the real estate strategy. What's this going to look like in 5 years? We actually draw out financial projections for a 10-year period, and then we have a terminal value. And then we can calculate or make an estimate about whether this is going to be a good return on invested capital or not. Because we don't want to make investments that are going to not pay off. You want your stores to be successful. You have to think long term. Same thing about people. You have to think long term about your people that you hire, people that you promote, and the people you're investing in. You're investing in their training. You're investing in their development. And if they're going to turn over in the first year, then that's a wasted investment. So you have to care enough about your people and invest in them so they're going to want to stick around and be with the company over a longer period of time. Also, competitors are innovating in ways that you can't even anticipate. Even as I'm talking, there's people trying to disrupt Whole Foods market and come up with new solutions to problems we hadn't even thought of yet. And you have to be thinking long term about how things may shift and change. When I met Jeff Bezos to talk about the merger, one of the first questions he asked me was, I want to reinvent the supermarket business. Can you help me do that? And I said, I've been doing it for the past 37 years, but Whole Foods, we could certainly use your help, and we think we can help you as well. So even asking that question is taking a long-term perspective, because you can't reinvent the supermarket business in a day or a year. That's a multi-decade type of proposition. But I believe Amazon is going to reinvent the supermarket business, and they already have started to do it.
Yeah.
So those are examples of long-term thinking.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That's a great story. And obviously, you've done a tremendous job of continually reinventing the industry for many, many years. You touched on something that I want to dig into a little more, which is this idea of investing in your people and caring enough about them so that they stick around, so that they're successful. One of the things that many, many people have given accolades to Whole Foods for is the incredible culture that you're able to create there. How do you think about creating a culture that really nourishes people's creative thinking and endeavors and gets them engaged and thinking entrepreneurially?
I can, I think, give you a broad formula for it. Obviously, the devil's in the details and how you execute it, but I can give you the basic principles for creating a great culture. First, it starts with purpose. What is the higher purpose of the business? Why does it exist? And is it a purpose that is going to, will it be an attractor? Will it be a purpose that people will get excited about and want to work for you? Whole Foods' higher purpose is to nourish people on the planet. And we have been living that purpose for 40 years, and we're still living it. And we draw people into the culture that are attracted to that purpose. And then beyond purpose, next is your core values, the things that are ways that reflect the purpose, the mission of the business. Like core values of Whole Foods are to sell the highest quality natural and organic foods, to satisfy and delight our customers, team member growth and happiness, suppliers as partners. We took each of the stakeholder groups and that we care about our environment and our communities. So we take each of the major stakeholders and created a core value around them that reflects back to the higher purpose of nourishing people on the planet. And then here's where it gets tricky. So you've got your purpose, you've got your core values, you've got your mission. Then it's how you're going to lead the company. And we call these leadership principles. And if you Google that, you'll see Whole Foods has 17 leadership principles. Amazon's got 14. Amazon did influence our leadership principles. We love them so much. We adopted many of their leadership principles. And then we took some that we thought were a little redundant and combined them, dumped a few that we didn't think fit Whole Foods very well, and then added the ones that were unique to our own company. Because those leadership principles are the way we do things. They're like the scaffolding that you want to build your culture around. So a leadership principle for Whole Foods, for example, that it's not that it's not a culture at Amazon, it's just not in their principles that we added on, is empowerment. We believe empowering our people to work. And a corollary of that is it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. One of the things that happens when you get larger is you begin to lose your entrepreneurial spirit because people are afraid they're going to be punished for making mistakes. So at Whole Foods, we say, go ahead. It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. And we encourage people to experiment. And that leads into innovation. So innovation is another one of our leadership principles. So as you go through those leadership principles systematically, your culture extends out from the leadership principles. And so one of the core values at Whole Foods that leads to our culture, I'm going to underscore this, they all do, but team member growth and happiness. That's a core value of the company. We have a great culture because we genuinely and authentically care about our people. We want them to be happy. We want them to learn and grow. We want them to be fulfilled. And so we build the culture to a large extent around serving our customers. But we believe the best way to serve our customers is to make our team members happy. If they're happy, then they're going to serve the customers better. And by growth, we mean giving them opportunities to learn and grow, become team leaders, to get promoted, to advance in the company, advance in the culture. I don't know how many times I've heard the story of team members saying, I took a part-time job here for the summer, and here I am 10 years later. Now I'm a store manager, because they got hooked on our culture or they liked what we were doing. It attracted them. And cultures tend to perpetuate themselves. Once you have a strong culture, it's like a body's immune system. It recognizes foreign invaders and sends out antibodies to fight them off. Cultures self-maintain themselves if you have a good, vigorous culture. So when Whole Foods goes to start a new store, for example, we call it the yogurt metaphor. If you know how to make yogurt, you take a starter culture from already existing yogurt that has living culture in it, and you put it in milk, whether it be dairy milk or almond milk or whatever kind of a yogurt you're trying to make. And then you get it the right temperature, and it will transform that milk into yogurt. The culture that you incubate it with will turn it into yogurt. Okay, same thing. When we open a new store, we try to make sure we have a starter culture in that new store. And that is, A, we want to get the team leaders and the store team leader, as many of them as possible that are already within the company, so that we incent them to move to the new store, because we know how important it is from a cultural standpoint to have veteran leadership in the store. But then we also encourage team members who've just been working for the company for a long period of time, even from different stores. In fact, we like to take culture from different parts of the company, not just have culture from one store, but from several stores. And then you're going to get a unique yogurt flavor as you've mixed that culture up. But then we don't have to do very much more. I mean, we do training. We have our general information guidebook, and we take people through orientation. We take them through training. We take them video training. But inherently, most of the learning that is done from the culture that we're inculcating in that new store. Because when a person comes from the outside, they take their cue from what's already there because they want to fit in. They want to figure out how to get ahead. They want to figure out how to make more money. They want to figure out how to get liked. And so when they first come in, they're highly sensitive usually to the culture, maybe not consciously, but they want to know what's rewarded and what's not rewarded. So it's not easy to set up a good culture, but if you build it around purpose, core values, and good leadership principles. And then here's the other thing. If you're the leader, you have to embody the culture. people pay a lot more attention into how you act than by what you say. And if you don't actually embody the culture, nobody's going to believe the culture is real. They're going to just see you as a hypocrite. So I have to be Mr. Whole Foods. I have to live the values. I'm the one person that can't get away with cheating in a way on the culture. I have to be the culture myself. And people look to me and they are looking for the exceptions that are made. And that's not just true of the CEO or the founder, but it'll be true of the other leaders as well. Because you have to walk the talk. You have to embody the culture. And Whole Foods isn't perfect, but we do a pretty good job of this. So those are some of the highlights for how you create and maintain and extend a culture.
I love the yogurt metaphor and the fact that the word is culture.
I'm a grocer, so I use a food metaphor.
It's great. No, it's really good. And just even the fact, the simplicity, the fact that the word culture is in both. It's such a profound yet simple way of thinking about the people that you have around shape the culture. It's so obvious. And yet when you master the basic fundamentals, things like that, it's really transformative.
Can I add one thing to it that's important?
Yes.
So cultures are living. They don't stay the same. They do evolve over time. And one of the things with the merger with Amazon, for example, is what Whole Foods has had to do, and is still doing, I might add, we're 3 years into it. We're trying to decide what aspects of the Amazon culture do we want to take inside of us and transform ourselves? What are the healthiest parts of Amazon that can help Whole Foods to become a better company? And also, what are the parts of Amazon that we don't want to take in? What are our boundaries? What are the parts that are uniquely Whole Foods that for us to stay Whole Foods, we can't change? What's core and what's not core? It's interesting because I'm going to do a retreat with my executive team next week with a facilitator to go over that very question 3 years into the merger. What is it that's changing that we don't want to change? And what is not changing that we think ought to change? And we're going to do a deep dive on that one. So cultures have to evolve. I always think about the culture. I feel like no one's been around the whole time except for me. So I have a very unique perspective. And I feel like it's part of my job is like a gardener in a way. What are the parts of our culture that are unhealthy or weeds that need to be sort of plucked out that are dangerous? And what parts of our culture are super healthy that we need to make sure get watered and nurtured and can grow even stronger and healthier? So most entrepreneurs and most leaders take their culture for granted. I advise people not to do that. Don't take your culture for granted. It's one of your most important assets, or it can be one of your biggest liabilities. And it's continually evolving. It has a continuity to it, a stability to it. And yet it is changing and evolving because the world's changing and evolving and the people are changing and evolving. And as people's consciousness changes, then the consciousness of that collective company is going to change as well. So I'm just arguing, be conscious about your culture, be aware of where it might be falling off or deteriorating, and work to improve that. And that it's a very important fact of leadership. Don't take your culture for granted, but continually work to upgrade it and improve it and help it evolve in a very positive direction.
Such a great perspective. And you've obviously been living that lesson for a very long time. You touched briefly on team member growth, and I know one of the chapters in the book digs into this concept about how vital you think it is to be continually learning and growing. That's really, in many ways, the fundamental premise of why we even have this podcast to begin with. And so I'm curious on your perspective of the need and the importance for continuous learning and growth.
So there are two chapters that are somewhat connected, but they're also different. One of the chapters is called Constantly Evolve Your Team. And in that chapter, we go over how to hire, how to train, how to help people to learn and grow on the team, and also how to fire. At Whole Foods, we have something we call recycle. So sometimes leaders get promoted above their head, but they got promoted because they were very successful at the job they were doing before. Most companies, when a person reaches this level where they're flailing and they don't succeed, they get fired. At Whole Foods, we think they got promoted because they were successful. And maybe they got promoted a little bit above their head before they were ready for it. So we've created a culture where it's not a bad thing to take a step back to the job at the same level that you were at previously. And we tell a story in the book about a guy that was a store team leader who started with our company at age 21, just started as an ordinary team member, became a store team leader when he was about 25 or 26, and began to fail at it. And we recycled him. We got him to step back to a team leader position back in the store at a different store. And he took that demotion with the right attitude. He said, how can I learn and grow so that I can become a store team leader again? And a couple of years later, he was a store team leader again. He became one of our best store team leaders in the company. So successful, in fact, that he got promoted to a regional vice president position and then became president of our Southwest region, where he was the president for over 10 years. He retired a year or two ago now, and he's now in the Whole Foods Hall of Fame. So that's a success story of a recycled position. If we just fired him, we would have lost all that growth that he did. So one of the things that you can do if you have a larger company is I do believe in coaching. I do believe in mentorship. In my own case, my father was my mentor for the first 16 years of the business's history. I fired him at age 40 from being my mentor because Whole Foods had gone public. We were very successful. He'd made a ton of money on his investment and he was retired at that point. So he just didn't want to blow it. I just wanted to grow the company and he wanted to play it safe. So I just decided at age 40 that I was done with the mentorship, and Whole Foods really took off after that. And that story's in the book. It's a little bit in the Conscious Capitalism book. It's also in the Conscious Leadership book. There's another chapter, though, that's relevant here, and that's a chapter of continuously learn and grow, that the leader has to continuously learn and grow. One of the best ways that you can help other people grow is to grow yourself. It's called the law of the lid. It's very difficult for a company to grow beyond the leader. The leader either helps lift it up to a higher state of consciousness, or the leader holds it back. If the leader holds it back, ultimately the company wants to outgrow the leader, and it's time for that leader to get out of the way. And you got to know when it's time to depart. That's forced me, I can tell you, I've held Whole Foods back numerous times from our highest potential. It forced me to learn and grow as a human being, to become more conscious, to become a better listener, to be more awake, and to just stay ahead of the growth of our own organization. So there's individuals growing, and then there's the leader growing. They're both important. And we go into some detail about both of them in the book.
I'm curious, how was the conversation and the dynamic with your father when you had to make that pivot?
So a little background on that. When I started business when I was 24, I had no business background. If you look at my resume, they were like a boys camp counselor, busboy, dishwasher, retail clerk, CEO of Whole Foods Market. That's the only job I've had since I was 24 years old. So I didn't have the business background. I didn't study business in school. In college, I studied philosophy, religion. Basically, I never even graduated. I've got 120 hours of electives, mostly in the liberal arts. And so I've read hundreds of business books. Once I started the business, I realized I don't know anything. And I just began to just swallow up knowledge from every source. My father had been an accounting professor at Rice University when I was a boy. And then he went into business and ended up becoming chief financial officer of an airline company. And then he became CEO of a hospital management company. So he knew a lot about business. And so from age 24 to 40, I never made a major move at Whole Foods without checking with him first, which was really good because I'd have wrecked the company if I didn't have that, and him as a coach and as a mentor. Oh, how the conversation.
Yes. So, that's great background. Let's dig into the conversation itself when you made that change.
Well, it was the most difficult conversation I've ever had to have. And it took me quite a while to work up the courage, right? Because I was partly afraid. Can I do this without my dad? I mean, is that the right move for the company? But we were fighting all the time in our board meetings. And it was always about the same thesis. I want to grow faster. And he just wanted to play it safe because he didn't want to blow it. And he kept saying, what's the hurry? I said, the hurry is the opportunity is there now. We have to grow faster. We have the money. We went public. We have the capital. I want to acquire companies. I want to open new stores. I want to be all over the United States. And he said, we could fail. And I said, we're not going to fail. We've never had a store fail. We're successful. We can do this. I could never convince him. So the conversation was, I went in and I said, Dad, I am so grateful for you because where would Whole Foods be without you? We never would have succeeded. You've taught me so much. You're my dad. I always love you. but I'm 40 years old. I want you to leave the board. And I'm still going to talk to you now and then, but I'm going to start calling the shots myself here. And I remember he told me I wasn't ready, that I still needed him. And I said, you're probably right. I still do. I'm still going to talk to you from time to time. I'm not breaking off the friendship. But I said, Dad, here's what I want you to do. I want you tomorrow to go sell half your stock in the company. Sell half your stock and you'll have all the money you'll ever need the rest of your life. You never have to worry. You're set for life. But leave the other half in because we're going to grow this company. And that other half's going to be worth a lot more money than the first half you sold. But even if I'm wrong, you got enough money. So that's what he did. Within 1 year, the stock price had doubled after my dad had left. And it had a happy ending, obviously, because Whole Foods grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. It's still growing. And my dad made a lot more money with the stock that he kept in than the stock that he took out. And we were friends and I still got his advice. But it was a huge step for me personally because I did not come into my full power as a leader and as a man until I let that codependent relationship go. It was one of the bravest things I've ever done. It was just firing my dad basically as my coach, my mentor. It was very difficult, but it worked out well for him, me, and the company. Win, win, win. Everybody won from it.
Did you seek out another mentor or how did you fill that void or did you fill it?
I didn't seek out another mentor. I sought out peers. I met other CEOs who were dealing with the same kind of problems I was dealing with. Because while you have to have relationship with the people in the company, and I have plenty of people in the company that are my friends, that I love, that I trust, that are wise, that I do run ideas by and give me advice, they still never understand it the same way a person is that's running a company themselves understands it. So that's why you have organizations like YPO. I'm not a YPO guy. They never invited me. But I've been parts of other groups of CEOs that meet and talk. So I really encourage you to get together with your peers. And hey, that's one thing Conscious Capitalism is trying to do. We're trying to create chapters in different cities so we can bring conscious CEOs and conscious leaders together to develop those type of relationships where they can help each other.
Thank you for sharing that personal anecdote. It's such an interesting dynamic to navigate. Bringing this conversation back to what we were talking about a moment ago, I'm curious for someone who's been listening that wants to take action on what we've talked about in some form or fashion, whether it's being a more conscious leader, whether it's implementing some of the principles of conscious capitalism into their life or their business, what would be one action item or piece of homework that you would give them to begin taking action on these ideas today?
To begin taking action, our book will be out in about 6 weeks. It comes out on September 15th. So I've got a whole book on suggested actions. We actually, in the book, we talk about practices that you can do in every chapter, practices that you can do to become more conscious in those areas, the areas of purpose, of love. The second chapter of the book is leading with love. Third chapter is about acting with integrity. So there's a ton of things that you can do that we're actually giving you a guidebook to become more conscious as a person and as a leader. If there's one thing I could tell you today is if you don't know your purpose yet as a human being and as a leader, then you need to find that because until you find that purpose for yourself and for your organization, you're going to always suboptimize. Because once you align your own life mission with your business, then you're going to release so much creativity and so much energy, it'll blow your mind. And then after you get that figured out, then the thinking using the stakeholder model and beginning to start trying to think in terms of win-win-win of stakeholders, that's an action you can begin to take right now. Start thinking about how you can create value for all of your stakeholders, that they're interdependent, that they're connected together, they're not separate, that you're managing this entire business and trying to create value for all of them. So nobody's losing. Everybody's winning. And you know what'll happen? If you start practicing stakeholder theory that way I just articulated it, it'll have a transformative effect on the rest of your life. Because everybody you start interacting with, you'll start acting in a way that you're trying to figure out how they can win. And you're going to be a good person to be around because you're always going to be cheering for the people you're with. You're not going to be envying them. You're not going to be wishing the worst for them. You're going to be wishing the best for them. And because you recognize that you're connected to them as well, and their success to a certain extent is your success as well because you're connected together. So practice win-win-win thinking. I'll give you that tip right now. find your purpose, practice win-win thinking. That's two tips for the price of one.
Perfect. Excellent. And John, where can people find the book, you, your work, et cetera, online?
It's online right now, available for pre-order at Amazon. So the title of the book is Conscious Leadership, Elevating Humanity Through Business is the subtitle. And there are two other co-authors. I want to make sure they get credit. Carter Phipps and Steve McIntosh, two good friends of mine who are also authors on their own right. We wrote this together. All three of us did it. It's definitely a group project. Thank goodness, because it's a win-win-win for all three of us.
That's right.
In a sense, I talked about, you asked me about leadership. If you write a book with somebody else, I have my own ideas, but you've got these people, your teammates that you're bouncing the ideas off of, and it magnifies, it grows. It's like one person takes your idea and they iterate on it and they give it back to you and then you iterate on that. It's sort of like the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Writing a book is a creative process. So your own mind is being creative. You're thinking of things you didn't realize until you started writing the book. But I found by having a couple of co-authors, it's magnified even more. So anyway, that's where the book is available. It'll be sold in bookstores and at Whole Foods Market. Every Whole Foods Market store will be selling it. Probably get your best price at Whole Foods or Amazon because it'll be heavily discounted. That'll be September 15th, but you can get the queue to have it delivered to you on September 15th from Amazon. If you're a Prime member, you'll get it delivered for free.
Well, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's truly an honor to have you on here and to hear some incredible wisdom from the amazing career and journey that you've had.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I can't believe a whole hour just passed. I hope our paths cross again and love to meet you sometime in real life.
Thank you so much for listening to The Science of Success. We created the show to help you, our listeners, master evidence-based growth. I love hearing from listeners. If you want to reach out, share your story, or just say hi, shoot me an email. My email is matt@successpodcast.com. That's M-A-T-T at successpodcast.com. I'd love to hear from you, and I read and respond to every single listener email. I'm going to give you three reasons why you should sign up for our email list today by going to successpodcast.com, signing up right on the homepage. There's some incredible stuff that's only available to those on the email list, so be sure to sign up, including an exclusive curated weekly email from us called Mindset Monday, which is short, simple, filled with articles, stories, things that we found interesting and fascinating in the world of evidence-based growth in the last week. Next, you're getting an exclusive chance to shape the show, including voting on guests, submitting your own personal questions that we'll ask guests on air, and much more. Lastly, you're going to get a free guide we created based on listener demand. Our most popular guide, which is called How to Organize and Remember Everything, you can get it completely for free, along with another surprise bonus guide by signing up and joining the email list today. Again, you can do that at successpodcast.com, sign up right at the homepage, or if you're on the go, just text the word SMARTER, S-M-A-R-T-E-R, to the number 44222. Remember, the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to a friend, either live or online. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us an awesome review and subscribe on iTunes because that helps boost the algorithm, that helps us move up the iTunes rankings and helps more people discover the science of success. Don't forget, if you want to get all the incredible information we talk about in the show, links, transcripts, everything we discuss, and much more, be sure to check out our show notes. You can get those at successpodcast.com. Just hit the show notes button right at the top. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next episode of The Science of Success.